106.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Andrew Solomon interviewed hundreds of parents, including Sue and Tom Klebold, for his book, Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. They're the parents of Dylan Klebold, one of the two teenagers who gunned down 13 students at Columbine High School in 1999 before killing themselves. Here's what Andrew Solomon wrote. Among the many families I've met in writing this book, the Klebolds are among those I would be most game to join. I underlined that. He wrote the book to explore what happens to families when children are so different from their parents. In the book, you meet parents raising children who are deaf, with dwarfism, mental illness, physical disabilities, even children conceived by rape, and children who become criminals like Dylan Klebold. Andrew Solomon joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
What a pleasure to be here.
You have written a provocative book.
Thank you.
Did you mean to?
I did indeed. Yes, that was the big idea.
And why were you so taken with the Klebolds?
You know, I had been looking at this larger question of what it means for families to grapple with children who are different from them in some way. And I had looked at a variety of what we accept as physical and mental disabilities. I'd even looked at prodigies, because that's also a difference that can be difficult. And I wanted to look at families of criminals in the first place because I wanted to indicate that your difficult relationship to your child can have to do not only with who your child is born being, but also with what your child does. And I also wanted to look at the idea that parents get so regularly blamed for their children's criminality. We used to say that schizophrenia was caused by refrigerator mothers, autism was caused by bad mothering, gayness was caused by overbearing mothers and meek fathers, and we've dropped all that. But we still blame families for children who commit crimes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see what it was like to talk to the family of someone who had committed a terrible crime and to see whether they appeared to be culpable or not.
Well, interestingly, they stayed in Columbine. They did not leave. They clearly wanted to talk to you. They love their child, Dylan. I mean, all these difficult issues, they have, at least, I'm not saying they've grappled with it, but they're living it.
Yes, I was really struck by how much they're living with it, by how much enormous pain they've experienced as a result of what happened, but by how helpless they felt in the face of it. I mean, they really were lovely people, and getting to know them didn't make me think, oh, I see what went wrong in that household. It made me think these are random things, and any of our children could turn out that way. We just can't know.
Did they know Dylan? I mean, in hindsight, did they feel like they knew their son?
You know, I remember at the end of the first weekend we spent doing interviews. We had done something like 20 hours of interviews. It was a very intense process. And on Sunday night, we were all exhausted, and we were sitting in the kitchen, and Sue was fixing dinner. And I said, if Dylan were here now, what would you want to ask him? And his father said, I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And Sue looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute, and she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. And I think they didn't know him at that level. I think they thought they did know him. I think they found out that they didn't know him. And I think it was the traumatic revelation that destroyed their lives.
You're right. It's easier to love a good person than a bad one. I mean, it's a simple declarative sentence, but I think it has a lot of meaning.
But it's possible to love a bad person, too. I mean, there's always that language about, love the sinner but hate the sin. That tends to get used in religious contexts. But I think that you love the child you have. I mean, I've had a lot of mothers of criminals who've gotten in touch with me since, and there's one of them from whom I had an email last night who was writing to me about the fact that her son's dog had died and that it was the last material connection she had to her son. She visits him in jail, but he had committed murder. And she talked about how strange it was to feel that she loved someone so much, that she was so pained to lose this dog, that she was so pained to lose the last tie to what it had been like when he was innocent and lived in her house, and yet she would say what he did was deplorable, and that if she could do anything to erase it, she would.
What's it like for the Klebolds, as you understand, to live in Columbine?
Well, they live in Littleton. Columbine is the name of the high school, right. And they live in Littleton, Colorado. And I was initially surprised by that. And Sue Klebold said to me, You know, if we had moved someplace else, she said, we would have had to meet new people who would have seen me only as the mother of that murderer. She said, here there were people who already loved us, and more importantly, there were people who had loved Dylan, and it felt to us like it was the safer, better place to stay.
And they have friends.
They have friends. They have a tight circle of friends. And they do have people who shared their perception of Dylan and who can say to them, you weren't crazy. That is the way he seemed to be. That's the person we believed he was, too.
You know, I have to say, reading that chapter, and for whatever reason, I kind of went to that chapter in your book, I was thinking also about Adam Lanza and the shooting in Newtown. And his, I mean, he killed his mother, Nancy Lanza, and the judgments we had about her. The way that she was described, I'm guilty of that in part, holding the parent responsible for the child.
Nancy Lanza appears to have been a more bizarre character than Tom and Sue Klebold are. But nonetheless, I think we often get confused in looking at these dramatic murder, suicides, shooting sprees. We're focused on the murder, which is, of course, the more upsetting piece of it. But actually, I think they originate in a suicide. I think Dylan Klebold was suicidal. I think it's clear that Adam Lanza was suicidal. And while some people think it's somehow indulging someone who did something terrible to focus on that suicidality, my feeling is that if we don't begin to understand why people become suicidal and why they become suicidal in a way that makes them want to take down the world with them,
yeah,
we won't be able to stem that tide of violence.
And in these two cases, taking down students, I mean, in a sense, taking down children with them.
Yes. And of course, Adam Lanza took down particularly young children, and
yes,
I think that what happened there was particularly demonic. But I think we've all been in such a rush to say it's really Nancy Lanza's fault. Okay, it sounds like she had some strange behaviors and she did get all of those guns into the house. Nonetheless, obviously, if she had known that her son was going to kill her, she would have gone about things differently. And I think the blame is not helpful in solving the problem. People somehow feel safer if you can put all the blame on the parents, and the people can then say, okay, but in our household, we brought our children up better. Our child could never turn out like that. The time I spent with the Klebolds convinced me it's a random occurrence. It's as random as having a child with autism or Down syndrome or schizophrenia. It can happen to anyone, no matter how good a job you do as parents.
The flip side of that, of course, is that there are also really bad parents who are terrible to their children. And if you learn about people that might be in prison for committing gruesome, horrible crimes, and you find out they've been abused, it doesn't excuse them, but there is that flip side as well.
Yes, I don't think that's the narrative for either Adam Lanza or Dylan Klebold.
I understand that.
But I think that what I think is that you can't guarantee by good parenting that you will prevent your child from ever escalating into criminality. But you can, by neglectful or particularly by abusive parenting, cause a child who might otherwise have developed in a more positive direction to have his underlying tendency toward criminality vastly exacerbated. And when I interviewed families of criminals, because I interviewed, you know, dozens of them, not just the Klebolds, there were some of them. I listened to what the children had gone through in their early lives, and I thought, okay, I can be very smug about the fact that I try to lead a moral life, but if I had grown up under those circumstances, who would I be? It's unknowable who one could be. It's the old nature-nurture argument. There's
sure
a lot of nature in it, and the nurture, I think the nurture does a better job of destroying people than it does of preventing people from heading that way if that's the way they're headed.
You took 11 years to write this book and became a parent, what sounds like, in the middle of writing it, which is such an interesting response to some of the narratives in here.
A lot of people said to me that they were amazed I had the courage to have children in the midst of writing a book about everything that could go wrong. And I said over and over again, it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much love and joy parents manage to find in their experience with their children, even when everything goes wrong. And I thought, if all of the parents I've talked to in this book of all of these exceptional children manage to find some degree of love for their children, then I'll be able to love whatever child I have. And it made me feel more confident. Mm-hmm. And I've had other people write to me and say the same thing. I had one woman who wrote to me and said that she was going to be a nun, and she read this book and it gave her such hope about parenthood that she decided to have kids instead.
Have you turned out to be that kind of parent?
Have I turned out to be
the kind of parent that, you know, that has that sort of love that you explore in this book?
I'd like to think that I have. I certainly love and adore my children. They're the greatest joy of my life. I'd like to think that I will, as they grow up, be the kind of accepting parent who's able to recognize whatever their differences are from me. I mean, the book looks at how difficult it is to raise children who are dramatically different, but everyone's children are somewhat different.
Sure.
And there's no one who brings up children who hasn't at some point looked at them and said, "Where did you come from?" And I feel like that thing of having to love your child as a separate being with his own separate issues, that's informed my parenting very profoundly.
And I think from the children's perspective, sometimes looking at the family and say, where did I, you know, how did these people make me? Or how do I fit into this family that doesn't seem to be quite the right kind of fit?
Yes, that's absolutely a universal.
In a chapter called Father, which is near the end of the book, you said, "I grew up afraid of illness and disability, inclined to avert my gaze from anyone who was different, despite all the ways I knew myself to be different."
So I am gay, and I felt when I was growing up that being gay made me marginal in various ways. Within my high school, within my lived experience, it was marginalizing. All of these conditions are marginalizing. I feel like the whole book is informed by that question of what did it mean to be gay, and really how did we get from the point when I was born in the 1960s, when gayness was an illness, to the time we live in now when gayness has an identity. And I wanted to look at all of these other experiences and say, each of them contains elements of both illness and identity. And the way to give people a healthy sense of self-esteem is to resolve as much of the illness as you can and to reinforce as much of the identity as you can. And I wanted to look at the methods through which that's achieved.
You also describe, I don't know if you still have dyslexia, but certainly having dyslexia as a kid growing up. And I'm curious about how your parents dealt with your dyslexia and how they dealt with your gayness, as you say.
So the dyslexia my mother picked up very early on, and she worked with me very hard on being able to compensate for it in various ways. I still have dyslexia, but I function quite well. Mm-hmm. When I applied to first grade, I was turned down by 14 schools who said I would never learn to read or write. And while I've had many problems in life, that's not one of them.
You were the big fat book here.
So, but I think the success that we had in figuring out a way to get around the dyslexia then left my mother feeling as though we could get around anything. And when it turned out I was gay, which she was not entirely comfortable with, she felt like there should be a way around that and we should be able to shift it and change it, and that there wasn't a way around. And so I grew up with a sense that I was damaged in some way in the sense of being gay, not because I was hideously rejected or thrown out of the house, but just because I felt it wasn't what one ideally wanted. But I've said that I have a sense of dyslexia not being very central to my self-image and gayness being very central. But if the dyslexia had proved intractable and the gayness had been easily resolved, it would be the other way around. I'd be here talking to you about life as a dyslexic.
Well, interesting. Let me take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Our guest is Andrew Solomon, and we're talking about a whole host of things that are contained in his book called Far From the Tree, and it's subtitled Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Might even have him read from the very beginning of the book as well to kind of set the stage here. We are also taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
The Mann Center supports WHYY. Tickets are available Wednesday, April 17th for the Mann's 2013 orchestral concerts. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra performs a Jerry Garcia symphonic celebration featuring Warren Haynes and Disney's Pixar in concert. The Philadelphia Orchestra returns with Symphonic Sportstacular, a new Legend of Zelda Symphony of the Goddesses, a tribute to Van Cliburn, Michael Feinstein and Friends, and more. Tickets for these and other concerts at manncenter.org.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Monsco, and I almost forgot my name there, talking with Andrew Solomon. He interviewed several hundred parents over an 11-year period for his latest book, and it's called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It's about children who are very different from their parents and how that relationship has evolved. Solomon's previous book, The Noonday Demon, won a National Book Award. That was about 10 years ago. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I asked you to read the very first paragraph of your book.
There is no such thing as reproduction. When two people decide to have a baby, they engage in an act of production. And the widespread use of the word reproduction for this activity, with its implication that two people are but braiding themselves together, is at best a euphemism to comfort prospective parents before they get in over their heads. In the subconscious fantasies that make conception look so alluring, it is often ourselves that we would like to see live forever, not someone with a personality of his own. Having anticipated the onward march of our selfish genes, many of us are unprepared for children who present unfamiliar needs. Parenthood abruptly catapults us into a permanent relationship with a stranger, and the more alien the stranger, the stronger the whiff of negativity. We depend on the guarantee in our children's faces that we will not die. Children whose defining quality annihilates that fantasy of immortality are a particular insult. We must love them for themselves, and not for the best of ourselves in them, and that is a great deal harder to do. Loving our own children is an exercise for the imagination.
And that's our guest, Andrew Solomon, reading from the very beginning of his sprawling book, if I can say that. And I, to be perfectly honest with you, I never thought about the word reproduction, the idea of reproducing, the sort of mini-me of reproduction.
So the book deals with parents of children who are different in various profound ways, children with autism and Down syndrome and schizophrenia, with deafness, who are prodigies, who are brought up in rape and so on. In looking at those extreme cases, I came to understand that all of parenting is, in some sense, this encounter with a stranger. And I thought, almost everyone I talked to in the research described how at the very beginning they thought, oh, I really love Gilbert and Sullivan. My child will really love Gilbert and Sullivan. You know, I'm really interested in football and I'm going to have a kid who wants to play football. And everyone has this alarming experience of finding out, no, I didn't just produce someone who's going to be exactly like me. And most essentially, I think parents think, I'm going to be a perfect parent, unlike my own parents. And the reason they're going to be perfect is that they will give their children all of what they wanted, which is what they didn't get from their own parents, without understanding this child will want other things, some of which you may not understand, recognize, or be able to provide.
You use the word selfish genes in that paragraph there, that they're not the parenting is necessarily a selfish act, but the idea of, I guess, recreating or reproducing oneself can be selfish.
Yes, and the
you get to do something that you weren't allowed to do, and you get to do that through your child.
And the idea, the evolutionary idea of species reproduction really essentially is that you sort of get everything figured out, you find your niche, and then you keep filling it over and over and over again. And
that's
you're
evolution,
a honeybee,
right?
And you produce honeybees, and you're a human being, and you produce human beings. But when you get up closer, you see how much shift there is, how much difference there is
because of the genes and the way they've come together, because the times are different for 10,000 different reasons. It's a difference you're introducing into the world.
You talk about something, vertical identities and horizontal identities, which is an interesting way to think about identity and difference.
So I propose that there are vertical identities which are handed down generationally from parent to child. There are a number of those vertical identities that are very difficult. Vertical identities would include ethnicity, nationality, frequently religion, usually language. All of these are things that parents have in common with their children. Right. And the tendency is for parents to reinforce their children's sense of identity early. So you could argue that in the United States, our post-racial presidency notwithstanding, it's harder to be a person of color than it is to be white. But there's no one doing research into how to ensure that the next generation of African Americans and Asians are born with creamy complexions and yellow hair. Then there are these other identities, which I've called horizontal identities, because you have to learn them as identities from a peer group because you don't have them in common with your parents. So being gay, having autism, being a prodigy, being transgender, your parents have no previous experience with this. And if you're going to construct a sense of identity around it, you have to find that identity from a peer group. And historically, we've always tried to cure the horizontal identities. We're always trying to get them to go away. We're always trying to figure out how to fix them. And so for a lot of the people who have them, when they discover a sort of cultural world around them of other people who are similar, usually in adolescence or thereafter, that's the great liberation of their lives.
As you said, you're gay, and it is interesting and frankly a bit shocking when we go back and we look generations ago when being gay was seen as a mental illness or an illness of some sort. And so much has changed so differently, you know, taken out of the DSM. We've got now a president who's for gay marriage. When it comes to that specific issue, it seems that there has been some pretty rapid evolution on this issue of sexual identity.
So I'll quote to you from two magazines from the 1960s. 1966, when I was 3 years old, Time magazine said, "Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life that deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness."
Is that a quote?
Yes, that's a direct quote. Now, we remember when things were like that, and we are aware of how much change there's been. But let me quote you also from 1969 from the Atlantic Monthly, that voice of liberal America. The ethicist Joseph Fletcher said, "There is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome baby away, whether it is put away in the sense of hidden in a sanitarium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person." Mm. And I think while a lot of ink has been devoted to the changing attitudes toward gay people, and obviously having a president who's come out in favor of gay marriage is gigantic, I think we forget how much change there's been in our attitudes towards difference of all kinds and how much more embracing we've become as a society. Many flaws, many problems, much progress to be made, but still how much more willing we are to accept the humanity of people who aren't quite like us.
Well, as you were doing that quote about Down syndrome, I'm thinking about, for instance, actors who I've seen who have Down syndrome, and they're on TV. They're in movies.
Right. And it was unimaginable at one point. People described having children with Down syndrome, even in the 1970s and 1980s, and saying, "I suddenly would turn on the television and there was no one who looked like me." And now there are people who are out there. There are people with Down syndrome who've written books. There are people with Down syndrome who are living semi-independently. The life expectancy for people with Down syndrome has nearly tripled. It's been a radical, radical shift.
So what has changed, do you think? What has caused that shift?
Well, I think what really has happened is that there were all of these rights movements in which people with all of these different conditions began asserting their rights, often with the assistance and support of their families. I think the most recent change has been the internet, which has allowed people to find one another.
But I also think that we're in the wake of a society, you know, it started with religious tolerance, and then there was tolerance of women and women's rights, and then there was the civil rights movement for people of racial minorities. And I think all of those sort of broke us into the idea that we needed to keep expanding our definition of the kind of people who were enough like us for us to accept them. And I think as black people in the United States got to be in a stronger position, it opened up the door for gay people. And as gay people moved forward, it opened up the door for disabled people. It's part of a larger movement that isn't always seen as a single movement toward justice.
And as you're describing that, I'm also thinking of a previous life when I used to do case management. And I used to there's a famous now closed mental institution in Philadelphia, Byberry. I remember going there, and that's where people who had mental illnesses were put. There was also a place, Pennhurst, where people with disabilities were put there, in a sense, away from the community. I think there's been a lot of problems associated with deinstitutionalization, but nonetheless, people are not farmed out and disappeared, I think, the way they used to be in the past.
So rather interestingly, in the 19th century, people weren't farmed out and put away. And then the eugenics movement began, which said that these people had these hereditary conditions. They were therefore shaming to their family because it was shown that the family had defective genes. There was a whole philosophy that rose up about that, really kicked in between the wars. Then we had the Second World War, which had the biggest experiment in eugenics that had ever taken place. There was general agreement that it was not such a great idea. So in
we're
the
talking the Holocaust
the
here.
The Holocaust, yeah, right. Absolutely. So in the aftermath of that, there's been a gradual movement away from that eugenic idea that somehow if we eliminate all of these people or hide them away, we'll make a more robust society, and a return to a more humane point of view, which is there will always be people who have many kinds of difference. And I think essentially that the diversity of human experience has value, and that trying to get everyone to be the same is no longer the thing that we're focused on.
And that's Andrew Solomon, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about some of the interviews and ideas in his new book, and it's called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Mary from Allentown to join our conversation. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Thank you, Marty. You're
Thanks.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
Andrew, I just fantastic that you're on the radio today. I am a huge fan.
Thank you.
I read The Noonday Demon, and I struggled with depression for 15 years. My mother struggled with depression for a long time. Mm. So that was a wonderful book. I have your new book, but I haven't read it. However, hearing you talk, I wanted to call in and share my experience as the parent of a child who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, which is a mild form of autism.
Sure.
Well, when we got the diagnosis, he was age 3, and his older brother is 11 years older than him. We got the diagnosis in the late 90s, and when the doctor told us this, we said, she sort of laid out the evidence that she had from the testing they'd done, and we looked at her and we said, well, how is this different from our older son, who everybody says is a genius? And she said, well, she explained to us how this could be and told us that when he was in high school, people would probably have no idea there was anything different about him. And my son is my younger son's graduating high school. And he is going to college at Humboldt State University next year to study botany.
Mary,
it was a long road.
Yeah, no, yeah. Mary, let me take your call because I think it's an important one, and I see Andrew Solomon's face lit up when you began to talk. But I'm curious about your thoughts to Mary's comment.
So autism, I think, is one of the central areas in which this argument about how much should we try to cure it, how much should we try to accept or celebrate it comes up over and over and over again. It's difficult with autism because it encompasses both someone like Mary's child and a kid with no language who's banging his head against the wall and seems to be abjectly miserable. But there's no question that the higher functioning forms of autism are associated with intelligence and insight. Intelligence and insight of which the rest of us are not capable. As the autism advocate Temple Grandin said, when the first cavemen were all figuring out how life worked, she said,
the social ones were yakking around the campfire, and the one with Asperger's syndrome was in the corner figuring out how you tie a stone on the end of a stick to make the first beer. And I think the tech sector, as we know it, is full of people with Asperger's syndrome, and that their systematizing minds are very strong and very valuable. So when we talk about curing or eliminating autism altogether, there's some autism that seems to be associated with suffering, and if we could resolve that, it would be great. And there's some that simply needs to be respected and admired, in which people need to be understood for who they are.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But do you think we're too hung up on labels? I mean, you know, we have labels for just about everything, and some come with a lot of baggage.
Many of them do come with a lot of baggage. I think we have a lot of labels. I think we live at this ironic moment in which social acceptance of difference is increasing at the same moment that medical progress is making some forms of difference easier and easier to eliminate. Mm-hmm. And I think we sometimes don't realize the competition that's going on between the social advancement and the medical advancement. I myself believe that the medical advancement is incredibly helpful to many people, and that the social advancement allows many people to have richer and more rewarding lives. The question I've asked throughout the book is, how do we knit them together and make coherent decisions? And labels are very useful in achieving both the social progress, because we say, don't disrespect this person, he's not just a weirdo, right, he has condition X. And they're useful in the medical context because they give people something around which to organize their research.
And a theme I see in your book is how parents decide what to do for their children. I mean, if the idea is to, you know, fix a condition, what does that do to that relationship? How does that child feel about what their parent is doing for them or with them?
Right. And the question a lot of the time is how effective the cures are. So if you can give someone a non-traumatic cure that completely resolves a condition that might make his life more difficult, it's likely that you'll go for it. Yeah. And if there's something which is absolutely untreatable and there's nothing you can do except accept it, you learn to accept it. But most conditions lie somewhere in the middle, and you constantly have to measure how traumatic is the cure? How painful is the cure? How effective is the cure? Is it worth going down that path? And I wrote in the book about someone I know who had jaw cancer, and she went through something like 80 different surgical procedures on various scales to try to repair it, and it never worked, and she ended up dying a tragically young death of a drug overdose. And I always thought, if some of that energy had gone into helping her to have a good self-image, despite the fact that she had this deformity, she might have had a much better life. On the other hand, if the surgeries had worked and her face had been fixed, she might have had a good life that way, too. It just turned out that that was impossible.
But there's so many choices, right? I mean, that's what you get from all this medical knowledge.
There are an enormous number of choices, and it's very difficult to make informed choices. You can't always see all the way down what's going to happen. I mean, there was one family I remember who said to me, they don't tell you when your child is born with the disabilities ours was, that there are going to be 100 surgeries. They tell you that there's going to be a surgery, do you want to do it? And then they say, oh, you need a second surgery, do you want to do it? He said, it's very hard to keep the long range in perspective as you make decisions about what to do or what not to do.
We're almost having a break here. You also talk about parents whose children are deaf and, you know, whether to give them cochlear implants or not. Do you, as a hearing parent, do you want your child to have what you have?
If I had a deaf child, I would probably give that child cochlear implants because I think communication between parents and children is crucial, and I would have a hard time really learning sign. But I say that having also witnessed an incredibly vital and inspiring deaf culture in which people have found enormous meaning. And if I had a child who was for some reason not suitable for cochlear implants, I think I would be able to help that child construct a really rich life in the deaf world.
And that's Andrew Solomon, our guest today on Radio Times. He received the National Book Award a number of years ago for a book called The Noonday Demon, and his new book is called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Sony Classics, The Company You Keep, a new thriller directed by and starring Robert Redford. with Shia LaBeouf and Susan Sarandon about one man's journey to outrun the FBI and his radical past. Starts Friday.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest on the investigation into the Boston Marathon bombings. When, if ever, will this city get back to normal? Also, the world still turns, so we'll check in on Capitol Hill and gun legislation. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. People want to talk to our guest, Andrew Solomon, about his book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Let me ask you about your chapter titles. And I wrote them down, and I kept going back to them. In certain ways, it almost felt like a medical textbook, the chapter to a medical textbook, rather than, I think, the book that you actually wrote. But these are the chapter titles: Deaf, Dwarfs, Down Syndrome, Autism, Schizophrenia, Disability, Prodigies, Rape, Crime, and Transgender. And then you do talk about both your childhood and being a parent yourself now. And I'm just curious about, you obviously chose those chapter titles for a very specific reason, and I'm curious why.
I wanted it to be easy for people to know what the topic of each chapter was. And at the beginning, I came up with some sort of more poetic and fun titles, and I just thought they were distracting. And I thought someone should know, oh, this is the autism chapter. Oh, this is the Down syndrome chapter. Oh, this is the transgender chapter. I thought that clarity, there's a lot of lyricism in the writing itself. At least I've tried for a lot of lyricism in the writing itself.
I would agree.
And I thought having those simple titles, it felt kind of modernist and clear, and not to say this is this particular aspect of it or this is what I think about it. If you want to know what I think about it, read the chapter and you'll get the whole story.
But I'm curious about people that are in the chapter on autism, how they feel like being in a book with a chapter on the children of rape, for instance, or Dennis Klebold.
It was one of the real indicators, I thought, that I was onto something, that everyone in the book objected to being in with the people in the other chapters. The criminals said, okay, we did some bad stuff, but we're not weird like those trans people. And the people with autism said, but we're so much smarter than the people with Down syndrome. And the people with deafness said, but deafness isn't really a disability, and how can you write about it with these other things? My uniting idea was that each of these kinds of difference considered by itself is quite isolating. There are only so many families dealing with deafness or schizophrenia or having a child who's a prodigy or bringing up a child conceived in rape. But my belief was, and it was borne out in my research, that there were many things that people had in common in encountering all of these qualities, and that difference is, in fact, not what isolates us, but what unites us, because the experience of negotiating difference within your own family is nearly universal. And so I wanted, in putting all of these groups together, to indicate that. And I was very pleased when I got a message shortly after the book party I had, to which I invited everyone in the book who was able to come. I got a message with a photo that some of the people I talked to had sent. It was a dwarf, a woman with schizophrenia, and the father of a boy with Down syndrome. And I thought, wow, okay, they're all getting together. They're all seeing one another. They've all recognized they have some commonalities. That's what I was working on.
How does the children born of rape, how does that, though, fit into this? And then we'll get to our callers.
So a lot of what I was looking at was the question of how families end up loving children whom they thought it would be impossible to love. And while some of the time the challenge is that you have a child with a severe disability, some of the time it's actually a question of where the child comes from. And I wanted to look at how these parents had ultimately had an identity as parents who had brought a child up who was conceived in rape, how the children gradually took on the identity that they had come out of something traumatic rather than out of a moment of love and ecstasy, and how it was that families managed to resolve that. And the difficulty those families faced was enormous. I'll always remember when I was in Rwanda and I had interviewed a lot of women there who had been raped in the genocide, and one of the women I was talking to, an incredibly beautiful, tall, slender Tutsi woman, said to me, I said, do you have any questions for me? And she said, well, you work in psychology, right? And I said, yes. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? She said, because when I look at her, I think about what happened to me and it gets in the way. She said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And it was unfortunately only a few weeks later, far too late to say it to her, that I thought how much love there was in that question itself. Mm,
that she wanted to love her daughter more.
Right.
But the rape, I guess, made that so difficult.
Exactly. And there were many of those stories, and many of them were very, very moving. I mean, at the more positive end of the spectrum, there was a woman I interviewed who had been raped at 16. When I interviewed her, she was in her 50s. She had had a very difficult time of it in one way and another, and but had ultimately pulled through. And I said to her, do you ever think about the man who raped you? And she said, well, I used to think of him with rage, she said, but now I think of him with pity. And I said, really, with pity? And I thought she must mean because he was so unevolved. I said, why with pity? And she said, because he has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one.
Well, of course, that taps into the, I don't want to get deep into the whole abortion issue, but of course, you know, those exceptions for rape and incest, I mean, that's built into the law. I don't know whether you're writing this to raise questions about that or not, or to think about this notion of choice?
I'm vehemently in favor of choice, and I think no one should ever be obliged to have a child she doesn't want to have or a kind of child that she doesn't want to have. And I think it's very important that there be access for rape victims and, indeed, for families who don't feel prepared to bring up children with disabilities to terminate the pregnancies if that's what they want to do when the conditions are detected prenatally. That being said, I would like to feel that when people make those choices, they do so from a more informed standpoint. And I thought it was important to say, this is what it's been like for some people who chose to keep these children. But almost all the people I know who did choose to keep such children said that they were grateful that they had a choice to do so and that it was a positive and affirming decision, and not that they were legally stuck in that position.
Let me get to, looks like Charles from Runnymede to join our conversation. Charles, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Marty, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine today. I've been waiting for this call for probably the last 50 years.
Really?
Mr. Solomon, I have a new chapter for your book, and it deals with parents who decided that one of their children wouldn't get a cesarean section when they desperately needed it when they were born, and their child became mentally retarded due to that, a blue baby in essence, back in the old days. Now, the gentleman I speak of is my little brother, who is 64 years old, and I'm a few years older than he is. You mentioned before about the Holocaust, and you mentioned also about babies with Down syndrome. It's no one's fault. How does one look at one's parents when they made a conscious decision to cause their brother to be mentally retarded for life? They've been dead 29 years and 23 years at this point.
And are you
I
taking,
don't think they have much to say about it.
And are you taking care of your brother, Charles?
For the last 18 years.
Right.
So I think there are many children who have got disabilities because of traumas or problems during birth, and there are a number of families in the book who said, we should have had a cesarean. If we did, our child wouldn't have. One family in particular whose child has a severe cerebral palsy. I think parents are usually trying to make the best decision they can. If they understood the seriousness of the injury they were going to create, I would guess that your parents would have gone ahead and had the cesarean section. People often don't recognize what an iffy project giving birth is, and I'm concerned
even among friends of mine, about people who choose to have home births where there isn't leeway to rush into an emergency C-section, as might be done. There are also, of course, people who are having C-sections who don't really need them and could deliver without them. That seems to me to be a lesser problem, though it's still a significant problem for some of the women who endure that. I, of course, don't know your parents, and I don't know your brother, and I don't really know you except from this interaction, so I wouldn't rush to pass judgment or to provide forgiveness to anyone, but I just think that often people don't understand the severity of the problem, and I don't think there's anyone who would deliberately have a disabled child rather than have a C-section if they truly understood that was the option.
And what I hear from Charles' question, which is that he's, I guess, living with the consequences of a decision, and it's probably really difficult for him.
I'm sure it's very difficult, and I admire you for taking care of your brother for 18 years. That's a steep task, and it's amazing you've done it, and I admire the rest of your family for coping with him and for giving someone who was born with birth trauma of that kind the capacity to live for 60-some years, as you've said he already has.
Charles, thanks for the call. Let's see what Alicia from Philadelphia has to say. Alicia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Mr. Solomon and Marty.
Hi.
And Mr. Solomon, I love your book. I'm reading it now. I'm on the Prodigy chapter. I've never read anything else that you've written, but it really speaks to my heart. And just my question is, there seems to be an overall theme in your book about how the parent, you know, you'll share a child or person with a certain ailment, let's say dwarves, and some parents choose to get limb lengthening, and others choose to have their dwarf children, you know, take pride in their dwarfdom. But you seem to approach, like, every example you have in your book as the parents just doing their best and just trying their best. And every parent, even the ones who abandon their children, like some of the disabled children, you give examples of they were abandoned, put into foster care.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like your point is that the parents are really just trying it, and they're doing everything out of love and sincerity. And my question is that it seems that that's the theme of the book, and I wonder if that theme was deliberate or if just that's the result of the research that you did.
Alicia,
like, if you...
Whether you discovered it as writing it. No, Alicia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
So I think there's no question that people deal with these things in different ways, and there's no question that some parents are cruel and abusive. But my experience is that most parents actually want the best for their children. They may not know how to do it. They may fail at it. They may do all kinds of things wrong, but that by and large, parents want the best for their children. Then there are the abusive and cruel and neglectful parents. Those parents are, of course, less likely to make themselves available for interview. They're less interested in telling their stories. But I also felt that it's obvious to everyone that there are parents who abuse disabled children and that those disabled children turn out badly. And the purpose of the book was to try to find models for how people can deal with these incredible difficulties and manage to find some kind of dignity in the experience. So that was really the focus of the book. I didn't stint on stories of people who were struggling, and there are a lot of families there. I mean, some, as you mentioned, who give their child up, and some who just describe being effectively destroyed by the experience of taking care of children who were too challenging for them. But I did want to look at the ways that parents at least try, and my experience really is that most parents try. Mm-hmm. They don't all succeed, but they mostly try.
Did you also, I mean, your previous book was about your depression. Did this book help dealing with your own depression?
I wouldn't say this book directly helped deal with my own depression, but I would say the unifying theme of these two books, and indeed of my previous books, one about Soviet artists and one a novel based on my mother's illness and death, was that I'm interested in seeing how people can, in effect, make lemonade out of their lemons. How is it that people take really difficult situations that they're given and ultimately find some kind of meaning in them? And I was struck over and over again by the way people did that. I mean, the prototypical story, perhaps, is Tom and Karen Robards, who had a child with Down syndrome, became enormously involved in changing the way children are educated, devoted their lives to it. And when I said to them, do you wish it had never happened? Do you wish your son didn't have Down syndrome? his mother said, well, for my son, I wish that, because for my son, it would be an easier way to be in the world, and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for myself, these experiences have so enriched my life and given me so much of a sense of purpose that while I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born that I could say such a thing, speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
Let me get Susan from Pottstown to join us. Susan, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Hi. This is so interesting, and I haven't read the book, though I'm eager to. I would agree with you about most parents trying hard. I have a 15-year-old with Down syndrome, and I often find myself in the company of other parents who are struggling and trying and working really hard for their kids. I was just wondering, though, if you have found any particular character traits in parents or skills, personality traits that really do allow them to parent well and be happy and functioning in their lives.
Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with will. There are a lot of personality types. You know, people who are buoyant and optimistic are going to have an easier time in this, as in everything, than people who are constitutionally given to pessimism, which is not to say the pessimism is evil or wrong, only that starting off with the sense that this is an unaddressable problem is going to make it a harder thing to deal with. But I think that there's always, for the people who are actually affected with these conditions, an interaction between the condition and the personality. So there are some people who have autism whose personality is to feel like they're really pretty content with who they are. And there are some people who desperately want to fit in and who are aware of how strange they are and are troubled by it. There are some people with Down syndrome who are very cheerful. There are some people with Down syndrome who are very depressive. The full mood spectrum exists for the people themselves, and it exists in their parents, and it represents another level of challenge. And sometimes we forget that there is a personality there, too. We think, okay, all we're dealing with here is autism. No, you're dealing with a person and with what effect autism has on that person's life.
Thanks for the call. You're almost out of time here, but I want you to describe in the most concise terms your family, how your family, who's in your family and how it works.
So my husband is the father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my closest friends from college had a divorce but wanted to have a family, and so she and I have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And then my husband and I have a son who is with us all the time, of whom I am the biological father, and our surrogate for the pregnancy is the lesbian mother of his two biological children in Minneapolis. So my shorthand for it is five parents of four children in three states. And it's been, as I said, the great joy of my life.
Well, Andrew Solomon, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is called Far From the Tree, and it's subtitled Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. For more information about Radio Times, including podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, email, archive, satellite radio, go to radiotimes@whyy.org. Heather Bromfield, our intern today. Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Assistance from Emily Bryant. Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.